It's sad, as California goes, so goes the nation.
California's 35 million residents have never been more diverse. And for the first time in the state's history, whites are the minority.
Today, a new report from the Census Bureau says America is going to look a lot like California a lot faster than they thought.
There are now over 11 million Latinos, 4.4 million Asians and Pacific Islanders, and 2.3 million blacks.
Now add increases in 49 other states, and voila, by 2042, minorities will be the majority. Racial and ethnic and religious changes coming quickly in America. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 14th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Adora. Coming up, the latest on the ground in the Republic of Georgia, including the growing refugee crisis and also reactions to this conflict on the presidential campaign trail here in the United States, plus a snapshot from the Olympics and a teachable moment in New Orleans. That's all coming up this hour, but first, these headlines.
A ceasefire between Russia and the Republic of Georgia may be holding after all. That's after some conflicting reports this morning. After giving those conflicting reports, Georgian officials say Russian tanks have indeed returned to the flashpoint town of Gori, but say they're only there to move Russian troops out of the city. In addition, the explosions heard that were heard from Gori are the result of Russian troops clearing unexploded ordnances. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is expected in Tbilisi after a stopover in Paris. Rice threatened Russia will be subjected to international isolation if it violates the latest ceasefire.
This is not 1968 and the invasion of Czechoslovakia, where Russia can threaten its neighbors, occupy a capital, overthrow a government, and get away with it. Things have changed.
Moscow has said that Georgian integrity is a dead issue, territorially speaking.
Syria has agreed to a long-standing Lebanese demand for a common demarcation of their border. The two countries are attempting to repair strained relations. They've agreed to establish diplomatic ties for the first time since both gained independence from France 60 years ago. Police say Arkansas Democratic Party Chairman Bill Guatney probably did not know Timothy Johnson, the man who shot him dead yesterday afternoon. Johnson had lost his job at Target only hours before he went on the rampage. Police shot Johnson dead after he fled the scene and led them on a 30-mile car chase.
The U.S.'s home foreclosure rate jumped 55% the past year. That's according to Realty Track, which is the biggest online repossession company online. It says around 1 in 500 households got a foreclosure filing last month, and California and Nevada were the hardest hit. The next census, well, it's not due out until 2010, but it projects that U.S. minorities will become the majority in little more than 30 years. Catherine?
Oil's down near $117 a barrel. The Dow down a little after 1%. Close at 11,532. The S&P opens at 1285. You're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We begin with the conflict between Georgia and Russia. At least five explosions have been heard near the Georgian city of Gori as plans for Russian withdrawal appears to have fallen into chaos, though it's not clear if the fighting has renewed. But witnesses say those explosions sounded similar to mortar shells and happened not long after a tense confrontation between Russian and Georgian troops on the edge of the city. Meanwhile, President Bush is sending Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to Europe, then off to Georgia. Stephen Eek is the Russian affairs analyst for the BBC. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
You're welcome. So we have these conflicting reports this morning from Gori, which of course is a town inside Georgia, close to the border with South Ossetia, where according to Georgian officials, there have been, it would seem, some new Russian troop movements, arrivals of more Russian troops and hardware. It may actually be the case that we need to treat that with caution, and it might simply be a matter of the Russians moving their troops around, as it turned out to be yesterday. If we think back a day, the Georgians said they feared the Russians were actually moving from Gori towards the capital, Tbilisi. It actually seemed that the Russians, in reality, were simply moving their troops and their military hardware around. What the Russians are saying is that they are going to stay in control of Gori for a few days to try to prevent looting and to allow food supplies and supplies of medicine to arrive until the area can gradually be returned to the control of the Georgian police. Much more interesting, I think, is this remark that we've just heard from Moscow on the status of these two separatist regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and Russia saying the question of Georgia's territorial integrity is over and Russia will respect the wishes of the people living in those two separatist regions.
What does that mean, Stephen, exactly?
What it means is that Russia is now looking towards, perhaps in the medium future, redrawing the map. The two regions that have had an undefined status legally, they proclaimed their independence when the Soviet Union collapsed, and since then have had a rather undefined status. But Georgia hasn't, Russia has never gone as far as actually saying it recognizes, unilaterally recognizes their self-declared independence. The fact that Russia now says Georgia cannot assume a territorial integrity in the form that it currently exists, the fact that Russia says now that it will respect the wishes of the populations in those two areas, opens the way, I think, in the medium term, to Georgia's borders being redrawn by its big neighbor, by Russia.
So we're talking about South Ossetia and Abkhazia. So essentially, does that mean to you that they would become independent countries in the mind of Russia, or would they be like North Ossetia, which is a part of the Russian Federation, although there is some autonomy in the way that it's governed?
I mean, it's an extremely complicated question legally, because no one has actually set out any sort of mechanism by which the two regions could be joined to the Russian Federation since the Soviet Union collapsed. It's important to remind our listeners that no territories have actually tried to join the Russian Federation. Its borders have been more or less unchanged.
Let's talk about that is an issue that we will investigate
yes.
further, but let's talk about the ratcheting up of the language, the diplomacy efforts,
yes.
both on the part of what the United States has been saying and what the Russians have been saying about the United States making a choice, essentially, between Georgia or a relationship with Russia.
Well, you've just played that great clip from Dr. Rice saying Russia needs to understand that Georgia isn't Czechoslovakia in 1968. That goes down incredibly badly in Moscow for two reasons. The first one is that the Russians think that the American Secretary of State talks in the language of the Cold War and doesn't herself understand that the world has changed since 1968. And they also point to what they claim are totally double standards on behalf of the US. Because of its invasion of Iraq a few years ago. They say the Americans didn't respect Iraq's territorial integrity and sovereignty, so please don't lecture us on the same issues when it comes to our dealings with Georgia. Of course, we all know that relations between the US and Moscow, between the West in general and Moscow, have been getting progressively worse over recent years. Perhaps this latest crisis, let's not forget it started just a week ago, is the catalyst for all sides to say, look, we need to arrive at some sort of new overarching agreement on how we see each other. It's clear, I think, that the talk of allied relationships and ever-deepening cooperation in the context of what's happened over the last week were very misplaced.
So Condoleezza Rice is on her way to Georgia. Any notion of what she'll be doing as soon as she gets there? Last question, we have a few seconds.
There's great symbolism to it, of course, but the Georgians have made clear that they're disappointed that the U.S. didn't respond more harshly to the Russian attack on the northern part of Georgia. But as we've seen, there is, I think, no question of direct American military involvement there.
Stephen Eek, thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Eek reports for the BBC. He's a Russian affairs analyst, and we're going to be talking a little bit later more about the humanitarian crisis that advocates say is building in the region. Catherine?
And, of course, we'll keep covering the story as it develops this morning. Well, Adora, the next U.S. census is not officially until 2010, but new numbers released overnight by the Census Bureau show that minorities are projected to become the majority by 2042. That's nearly a decade earlier than previously thought. What that jump could mean, what we even mean by minority anymore, are questions that we're going to put to Sam Roberts, who writes about the new numbers in today's New York Times. He joins us by phone. Hey, Sam.
Good morning.
Now, what surprises do we have in these numbers?
Well, I think America is waking up to a country that's changing a lot quicker than even everyone thought it was. The census is now saying that so-called minorities, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, a couple of other groups, will become a majority of the country by 2042. That's about 8 years earlier than they projected just a little while ago. And also that the country, because of immigration, because of higher birth rates among minorities and particularly immigrants, is growing even faster. The census had said we would not surpass 400 million until sometime after mid-century. Now it's saying that we will top 400 million in 2039. Important to keep in mind that we just hit 300 million 2 years ago.
Oh, all right. And you keep hearing from people who study the census that these numbers are all unprecedented. What is so unprecedented about them?
Well, what's unprecedented is the pace of change. It is really remarkable how fast we're growing. And part of that is because the numbers are so much bigger. The base is so much bigger. We've got so many people coming in that the percentage of people who identify themselves as Hispanic or Latino will increase from 15% now to about 30% by the middle of the century. That's an enormous increase, and they'll account for about 1 in 3 Americans. Blacks will stay roughly about the same. Asians will just about double from about 4 or 5% to 8 or 9%. And that's a remarkable change in a relatively short period of time. What's important to remember, of course, as you suggested in the beginning, is that this country has always been changing, always been evolving, and the question is, what is different, if anything, now? I think the biggest difference is just how we define minorities.
That was going to be my next question. You know, this is based on what definition of minority, and how will that definition change in the future?
Well, I think it will change. I think that it's very interesting when you look at people who identify themselves as white, for instance, you know, and we've got to be careful to think of that as a plus or anything, but it's certainly an indication of stability in the country. This has always been primarily a white country, at least since the Spanish became the first minority centuries ago, when Indians and Polynesians were in the majority. It's important to remember that most people still identify themselves as white, including Hispanics, that Hispanics are an ethnic group, a heritage group, as the census defines it. And if you say, well, what's so different about them than Irish or Germans or Eastern European Jews or Italians a century or more ago, the answer is probably not very much.
Quickly, we were down to seconds, I'm afraid. What does this say about how our future is going to look?
Well, it's going to look the country will be older, and the older population will be mostly whiter, and the younger population will be mostly darker in complexion and less likely to be citizen because they're more immigrants. And, you know, there is potential for conflict. Managing that diversity is probably going to be the biggest challenge of the 21st century in America.
Sam Roberts, thank you so much. Sam's a New York Times correspondent who writes about the new census projection in today's New York Times. Reminder, by the way, that we always like your take on any news story you hear at The Takeaway. 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also taking your ideas on how you would change your school system. We'll be talking a little later about New Orleans and their teachable moment. What would you change in your schools? Let us know, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about how New Orleans revamped its school system in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. We'd like to hear from you. What would you change about your school? What needs to change in your child's school? Go ahead. Tell us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll play some of your responses later on in the show. We'd love to hear from you. Or you can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Adora?
In a presidential election year, the crisis in the Republic of Georgia has brought immediate responses by the candidate. Senator John McCain has expressed immediate and absolute support to President Saakashvili of Georgia.
For every American, when I say to him, today, we are all Georgians.
Barack Obama has been a bit more measured, not unlike the Bush administration. Initially, he urged restraint on all sides, but his language grew stronger as the conflict has continued.
There is no possible justification for these attacks. I reiterate my call for Russia to stop its bombing campaign.
Jeffrey Mankoff is an adjunct fellow of Russia and Eurasia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He joins us now. And Jeffrey, how would you describe the statements made by John McCain and Barack Obama?
Well, I think it's part of the normal political process, the normal part of trying to distinguish one from one's opponent during the course of a political campaign and to construct a kind of narrative that plays to the strength of each of the candidates.
And what have we learned about them, how they would act given this kind of crisis in the way that they have responded? Let's start with John McCain.
Well, I think the notable thing about McCain's response has been that it was very quick and it was very coherent, I suppose, in the sense that he had a very well put together, convincing, at least internally, narrative about what was going on, and it provided him with a lot of clarity about the nature of the response that outside powers should pursue. It was portrayed as being a very cut and dry case of Russian aggression against a smaller sovereign state that was a democratic and pro-Western ally of the United States and that need to be confronted head on. And I think this plays into McCain's interest in portraying himself as being a very decisive, risk-taking, active kind of leader.
And that's interesting because you describe that as a very, very much like a response President Bush might have given pre-2006.
Yeah, I think that's right, and especially in the sense that it seems to be kind of informed by this particular worldview about, you know, the importance of spreading democracy and the key role of the United States in being at the forefront of that wave of spreading and defending democracy around the world. And that, of course, is very much like what at one point was being referred to as the Bush Doctrine before, you know, a couple of years ago when the situation in Iraq changed and, you know, seemed to be kind of unwelcoming to that way of dealing with the world.
And let's contrast that, though, to Bush post-2006 and compare that to how Obama has responded.
Yeah, I think, you know, Obama's response to the crisis in Georgia is a little bit more like the more nuanced approach to dealing with Iraq and other crises in other parts of the world that the Bush administration's adopted since 2006, deciding, for example, to talk with North Korea, sending U.S. envoys to meet with their Iranian counterparts, recognizing that as much as we may dislike particular leaders or the actions of particular countries, it's not enough for the United States to simply offer one-sided condemnations, but has to actually take into account the broader universe of its interests in any particular relationship. And I think you get that in looking at Obama's discussions about Russia and about, the way that the United States has to deal with this crisis. It's obvious that, especially as time goes on and the intensity of the Russian response has become clear, Obama has become more critical of Moscow. But at the same time, I think he recognizes, and he's been at pains to point out, that the United States has a wide range of interests that it has to pursue in common with Russia.
But isn't that a tougher sell to voters? It's not a quick soundbite. If you could just respond to that lastly.
Yeah, I think, that's the risk that he's taking. I mean, I think the Obama campaign has been operating under the assumption that you don't need to talk down to voters, that voters are actually, willing to respond in an intelligent way to problems around the world that really are too complex to be reduced to a soundbite. That's not an approach that political candidates are always comfortable taking, but I think it's a line that, in building his foreign policy and his foreign policy message, Obama has done.
Jeffrey Mankoff, adjunct fellow of Russia and Eurasia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you. Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who has some headlines for us.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. A ceasefire between Russia and the Republic of Georgia appears to be holding despite reports of new violence in the flashpoint town of Gori. Georgian officials say explosions in the town can be attributed to Russian troops clearing unexploded ordnances. And they say Russian tanks are moving into the city, but only to help their troops move out. The U.S. has threatened Russia with international isolation, if it violates the latest ceasefire. Elsewhere in the region, leaders of the two breakaway regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia have visited Moscow. Russia said today that Georgia's territorial integrity is a dead issue. And in other news, police are still searching for a motive after a gunman burst into the Arkansas Democratic Party headquarters and killed party chairman Bill Guatney. Police say there is no indication that Timothy Johnson knew Guatney. Johnson had been fired from his job at Target only hours before he went on the rampage, and police shot Johnson dead. The number of foreclosures on U.S. homes spiked 55% in the last year. The U.S.'s biggest online repossession market, RealtyTrack, says that around 1 in 400 households in the U.S. get a foreclosure filing last month alone. California and Nevada had the highest rates of foreclosure. U.S. minorities won't be in the minority for much longer. New government projections say that people of color will outnumber those of white European ancestry by the year 2042. Asians and Hispanics should expect to see their numbers double. And that's a look at your national and domestic headlines.
Thanks, Pam.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 14th, and we are quickly approaching the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and we're going to be talking about some innovations in the public school system there in New Orleans. We want to hear from you. How would you make schools better? Or do you have great schools, and how did they get that way? Your school, your kids' school, what do you think makes school systems work? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Catherine Lampfer is in for John Hockenberry. Catherine.
Hey, Adora. As you know, we've been getting conflicting reports on the ceasefire in the Republic of Georgia, in the Georgian city of Gori, I should say, as plans for the Russian withdrawal continue to change. We now hear from the Georgians that the report of explosions was the Russians blowing up ordnance that they didn't want to use anymore. Well, of course, we'll keep people informed on what's going on with these shifting circumstances. What is certain is that there are literally tens of thousands, perhaps as many as 100,000 people who have been displaced in this conflict. We're going to go now to the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, where Maya Cordova, a spokeswoman for the International Committee of the Red Cross, is going to tell us more about the efforts to help these people. Good morning, Maya.
Good morning.
Could you tell us how many people do we know are displaced?
Well, I can give you the governmental estimates that show that it's at least 50,000 people here in Georgia.
Okay, at least 50,000 people in Georgia, which means that some people have been crossing the border into elsewhere. What is the biggest challenge that you're facing today?
Well, that's a conflict which caused serious humanitarian crisis. We see people who had to flee their houses without bringing anything with them. So what we see in the shelters where the people are placed now, they are in need of food, of water, of essential items. And this is where ICRC focuses its efforts these days. Besides, we are here to reinforce the local medical capacities of the doctors to treat the war-wounded civilians.
All right. Would you say, how are people showing up? Like, I read a report where a woman was milking her cows and someone pulled her away and said, you have to run now. Tell me what it's like when people walk through these shelters.
Well, in fact, the movement started from the very first hours of the conflict. And even today, we have the new people coming in. Again, that's why the figures change very quickly. What we see is that spontaneously new centers emerge, and we are now having difficulty follow up of how many of those centers currently existing in and around Tbilisi as well as in western Georgia. Well, difficult to say because our office is reached by people who are mostly anxious at this point about that because they're trying to find their relatives. They lost contact with the family members. So it's this what I mean with this humanitarian crisis. It has many angles.
All right. Now, we also hear that one of the problems that you're facing is lack of access to places where you think people are, for instance, South Ossetia.
Well, that's very true what you're saying, despite our repeated efforts to request safe and unimpeded access to South Ossetia. It is not a case so far, and this is our major challenge at this point, because we understand we have to be there now to be able to act in favor of the population that was affected in a result of this conflict.
And who stands in the way of you getting to these people? What blocks your access?
Well, as I said, it's not about blocking us, but it's rather no one guarantees the unimpeded and safe access to South Ossetia. However, we continue our efforts with both governments, Georgian and Russian, and we hope very much that this is soon possible.
All right. And I know that there are some people who are trapped in their homes. What are you hearing about that?
As I said, our office is rich these days by people who give us various information about some isolated areas that they expect their relatives staying for the moment. This is why I'm saying it's so essential that we reach as soon as possible the South Ossetia conflict zone to be able to give help if there are any in such isolated areas.
I know that President Bush from this country has said that he was going to send aid to Georgia. Have any planes been arriving?
Well, yes, there have been. There's, in fact, numerous information from various agencies, various governments that are mobilizing. Humanitarian experts are very much mobilized. The same is true for us, for ICRC. We have already been able to shift some 95 tons of humanitarian assistance, but the need is still very high.
All right. I want to thank you for joining us. That is Maya Antolova.
Yes.
Maya Cordova, who was joining us from Tbilisi and the International Committee of the Red Cross, would also like to quickly go to another person we have on the line. And that would be Yuri Sharonovkov, excuse me, joining us from North Ossetia. Yuri, thanks for joining us. What can you tell us about the situation on the ground in North Ossetia?
Good morning. In the Russian Federation, the International Committee of the Red Cross estimates that at least 12,000 people fled to North Ossetia from South Ossetia. And we mostly speak about women, children, and elderly. And around half of these people who fled to North Ossetia have managed to contact the relatives they left behind by telephone or by the other means. At this stage, the International Committee of the Red Cross in North Ossetia is providing the hospitals in North Ossetian towns with kits for treatment of war-related wounds, and we already provided six kits for five hospitals in North Ossetia that are good for treatment of roughly 150 wounded patients.
All right. I want to thank you for giving us that update, Yuri. No, it's tough over there. Thank you so much. That is Yuri Shafarenko. He is a communications delegate for the International Committee of the Red Cross, and he is talking to us. He was talking to us from North Ossetia. We're going to go now to Femi Okey, who has slipped in with the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. Coming up to 21 minutes to the hour. Just got some new economic numbers in. They came out a few minutes ago. Consumer prices jumped 0.8% in July, leaving inflation rising at the fastest rate in 17 years. Jobless claims fall less than expected last week, indicating continued stress in the labour markets. And some news from the housing market, and it may not come as a surprise to many of us, foreclosures are way up from this time last year. Filings went up 8% in July and are up 55% over foreclosures registered in July of 2007. Let's go back to the Republic of Georgia, where a Georgian official is saying the explosions reported near the city of Gori just hours ago aren't a Russian assault on the city. He says Russian troops are only exploding unused ordnance. And Georgia is confirming that Russian tanks have returned to Gori, but says they're only there to help Russian troops complete their pullout from the area. The British oil giant BP says it's reopened a pipeline running through the Republic of Georgia, but it's keeping two other Georgia pipelines closed while it keeps an eye on the security situation in the country. And finally, in Zimbabwe today, government authorities have confiscated the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai's passport and are stopping him from leaving the country for a summit in South Africa. And that comes according to an opposition party official. The power-sharing talks between Tsvangirai and President Robert Mugabe stalled earlier on this week. Sounds like we're getting back to business as usual, unfortunately. Mm. That's a look at your domestic and international headlines for now.
Thanks, ma'am.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and boy, has it been a couple of days of Olympic glory, and of course there have been some terrible disappointments.
Yes.
2 days after American Jason Lezak swam a stunning final leg in the men's relay, the man he beat, the man from France, edged him out in the 100 freestyle today. Tomorrow, another group. Now, let's remember there are other sports besides swimming happening at the Olympics.
Oh, you're making that up.
No, not at all. Track and field. And our friend Lynn Zinser from The New York Times will be covering those events for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Lynn, or I should say good afternoon for you.
Yes, it's a good afternoon here, a good soggy afternoon in Beijing.
Speaking of soggy, track and field tomorrow, I'm assuming that will be in tip-top shape. We've all had our head around Mr. Phelps and all of the swimming and gymnastic dramas. Clue us in. What are we up for? What should we be paying attention to when it comes to the track and field events starting tomorrow?
Well, track and field gives you a treat because they are kicking off their competition on the first day with the rounds of the men's 100 meters. And if all of the expected actors get through to the final on Saturday, it could be the most spectacular men's 100 meter finals ever. The three fastest men in history are all in this race, one being American Tyson Gay, The other two from Jamaica, Usain Bolt and Asaf Appel. Usain Bolt set a world record in a meet in New York back at the end of May. And so this is one of the more highly anticipated events, and it comes at you right off the bat. So that's definitely something to watch.
And it's like the fastest man on the planet race, right?
Yes, it is. It is. It is the fastest man on the planet race. But the Olympics throws in a little edge to it because, unlike most meets, you have to get through four rounds to win a gold medal. So that's a little tougher to do than just to sprint 100 meters and the first one there wins. You have to make it through four rounds to take the gold medal. So it's not always just the fastest guy, but the strongest runner who wins.
Yeah, because you make that really interesting point, which is in swimming, they've broken all kinds of records this week, but that we really shouldn't expect a whole lot of records to be broken in track and field, essentially because the way it's set up differently, like you've just said, four races has got to be a lot more tiring than just one.
Yes, it definitely is. It separates out the strong runners from the merely fast. And so it makes it a whole lot more difficult because when they're fresher in the early rounds, they also don't want to expend energy in a kind of a world record time because all they're really trying to do is advance to the next round. So then by the fourth round, when they are ready to go all out, they've already run three rounds, so they're not exactly as fresh as they might be. Now, Tyson Gay at the Olympic trials ran his most amazing race in the finals, a 9.68, which would have been a world record if there wasn't a 4.0 meters per second wind behind him, which disqualified it as a record, but it was a spectacular race in the finals. So it can be done, and certainly the competition is going to bring out the best in these guys. But in a four-round race with all the pressure of the Olympics, a world record is a lot to ask for on top of that.
Lynn Zinser, thanks for cluing us in on that.
Oh, hey, no problem.
Oh,
my
by
pleasure.
The way, Lynn, real quickly, how's the air there in Beijing?
Well, today it's wet, but it has been very, very, I would say foggy. I'm not quite sure it's all pollution. It's a lot of humidity and haze. It is incredibly humid here.
Lynn,
and the runners are far more worried about the humidity than the pollution.
Lynn Zinser, thanks. Lynn Zinser
Thank you.
Reports for The New York Times. She's in Beijing.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have headlines for you. Femi Okeh is here. Femi?
Hi there, Adora. Let's take about 10 off that and make it 12 minutes to the hour. Just testing you, seeing if you were awake. Good
we're
morning
awake.
Again.
We're awake.
12 minutes to the hour. The Labour Department is reporting that jobless claims dropped by 10,000 last week. But that's a smaller decline than economists expected. Unemployment is still at its highest level in 6 years. The United States is bringing humanitarian aid to Georgia to help the thousands of displaced people inside the country. Transport planes touched down in the capital city, Tbilisi, today, carrying bedding and other basic supplies. Long-time tensions between Syria and Lebanon appear to be easing. The two countries have just announced that for the first time in more than 60 years, they'll be establishing official diplomatic relations, and they'll also negotiate an official border. The dividing line between Syria and Lebanon has been disputed since the 1940s. And finally, going for Olympic glory can sometimes be more about the pain than the glory. A young Hungarian weightlifter is getting a lot of attention today because in the middle of competition yesterday, he was attempting his final lift of 326 pounds. Then disaster hit. His elbow gave way. Listen in to the commentary.
Now, Janos Baranyai from Hungary. Oh, no. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, no, that's terrible. Oh, he's dislocated. That's just awful.
Just to get you up to date on that situation, the competition judge said it's a dislocation. He'll be all right, but it's just an ugly thing. The action replay is not really for the squeamish, but it just goes to show you how much these weightlifters are trying to carry. It's more than sort of triple their body weight. And when the competition gets tougher and tougher, they're trying to lift 400 pounds in one single lift. Exceptional.
I so did not want to hear that, Femi.
Yeah, it's disturbing. But thanks for the update.
Yeah.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
Scouring the Olympics.
Now we're going to scour Louisiana because we're looking at the three-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. It's coming quickly. And within weeks following Hurricane Katrina, Louisiana educators were saying they hoped that one good thing to come out of it would be a complete overhaul of the New Orleans perennially troubled and failing public school systems. And change is a-coming. Tracking that innovation is Paul Tough, an editor for the New York Times Magazine. His report will be in Sunday's New York Times Magazine, and he joins us with a preview. Thanks for being here, Paul. And let's start with just how disastrous the public school systems were in New Orleans pre-Katrina.
Well, before Katrina, New Orleans had almost the lowest scores in all of Louisiana, and Louisiana was one of the lowest performing school states in the whole country. And kids that I talked to down there said that before the storm, their teachers often just didn't really think they could succeed. The school system was mostly poor, mostly black, and a lot of these kids felt like their teachers had just written them off.
And in fact, the school system was on the verge of being taken over by the state. That's just how bad it was, performing so poorly, even on a national scale. But today, things are very different. There are 65,000 students who were in the system pre-Hurricane Katrina. Now it's somewhere around half. And hundreds of innovators, not only administrators, but teachers and consultants, have all found themselves down there trying to reconstruct a school system. Tell us what they're doing.
Well, there's sort of two things happening at once. One is a structural change. So after the hurricane, the school system was basically wiped out. All the teachers were fired. The kids were scattered all over the country. And in its place is this new kind of school system that, instead of being run like a regular school system from the top down, is run by what is called a portfolio model. So the school system, what the people at the center of the school system say they want to do is just put schools in business and take schools out of business. So as a result, more than half of the kids in the city are being educated through charter schools, and even those schools that aren't charter schools are often run with a much lighter hand than in most places. And then at the same time, there are lots of nonprofits like Teach for America and this new organization called New Schools for New Orleans that are sending lots of ambitious young educators, mostly, down to New Orleans to try to make a difference. And just being down there, there's really kind of an exciting feel. People who have much higher goals than they did in the past.
And not just exciting for those who are involved in all of this change in the system, but for students and their families, some of whom you've met. You want to tell us about Tony?
Tony Petit, yeah. Yeah, this was so I hooked up with two principals from a brand new charter school called Miller McCoy Academy and went with them as they went door to door meeting each one of their incoming students. This was just last month. And Tony Petit was in third grade when Katrina hit, and he went to Denver with his family. And when he got there, he found out that he was way behind all of the other kids. Caught up to a certain degree in a year in Denver, but then when he got to New Orleans, fell behind again. So this year, his parents signed him up for this new charter school. So I went with them as they tried to sell his mom and him on what this new school would be like. He'd have to get there at 7:30 every morning, stay till 6 if he hadn't done his homework the night before, wear a blazer. And it just, for his mom, it had a very different feel. It had, instead of the school being kind of a distant institution, here were the principals actually showing up on her doorstep and promising what they were going to do.
And they had to sign an agreement, right? I mean, that's part of this idea of having everyone in the family committed to this child's success.
Yeah, a lot of charter schools are doing that these days. It's called a family school compact. And yeah, in some ways it's sort of symbolic. It's just saying in order for Tony to succeed, his mom's got to be on board, he's got to be on board, and the principal and his teachers have to commit to trying to get him to college.
This is one of the country's most nagging questions, is in urban poor school districts, how to narrow that gap between the small percentage of kids who tend to do really, really well and those who don't. And they're looking at it a little differently there in New Orleans. You want to explain?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a huge question all over the country. And what I think has been happening is that there are some really promising examples of schools that are succeeding here and there around the country. But what hasn't happened so far is there hasn't been one school system that has really succeeded in a big way. So the goal of the people running the system and a lot of the reformers who are coming down there is to use New Orleans as kind of a model, as a test case, to show that if you run a school system differently, if you pour certain types of resources into it, you can make a big change in the scores and in the results of poor kids fairly quickly.
And in the case of Tony Petit, describe the promise that the school and the principals have made to him.
Well, they said they'd get him to college, which I don't think there were a lot of people promising beforehand.
And this is part of the notion of expectation, right? And when you're talking about the decentralization of it, essentially what they're suggesting is that you create a system where you have a lot of charter schools, so it is a public-private partnership, right? And that the survival of the fittest, in a sense, those schools that do well with those lowest-performing students survive, and those who don't go away.
Right. The principals who are starting this new school were from Memphis, and they had both run really successful public schools there. But they were attracted by the idea of being held accountable, of running their own school where if they could make it, they would succeed. If they didn't, they'd lose their charter and be out of work.
So you describe it as a very exciting time there.
I think so. Yeah, it's promising.
That's Paul Tough. He's an editor at the New York Times Magazine. Thank you, Paul. And you can find his report on Sunday in the New York Times Magazine. He also has a book coming out later this month called Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem in America. And that's another innovator in the education world.
Right, right. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry, reminding you we're always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, Friend Feed, Twitter.
On today's show, we've been talking about minorities becoming the majority across the United States, according to the Census Bureau, the latest from the conflict in Georgia and New Orleans, the massive school experiment following Hurricane Katrina.
Hey, go ahead, tell us what you think about any of these issues or anything in the news at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And right after Femi Okay's newscast about the Hungarian weightlifter, well, we got this.
Hi, this is Dan from Boston, and I just want to say that Femi Okay's coverage of the Hungarian man that blew out his elbow, probably the single weirdest way I've ever woken up. Congratulations, Femi. I've heard a lot of things in my life and seen a lot of things, but just to wake up to that, that was probably the most disturbing. Thank you very much.
It is disturbing what happened to that weightlifter.
Let's go to today's takeaway.
Managing that diversity is probably going to be the biggest challenge of the 21st century in America.
That was New York Times correspondent Sam Roberts talking about how American minorities will be the majority in 2042. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Where were you when the lights went off? Oh, this afternoon we marked the fifth anniversary of the largest blackout in North American history. Stretching from Ohio to eastern Canada, some 50 million people were left in the dark. 5 years later, are we any smarter about how we use our power? We'll leave the lights on for you. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 14th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Adora.
We're taking a look at the power grids, new technology, and big plans for the future. Also, the Catholic Church. How much has really changed in the wake of the sex abuse scandals? Zimbabwe, the latest in the tug of war for power, and texting for votes. Well, we're going to explain that one to you. That's all coming up this hour. But first, these headlines.
Despite conflicting reports from the Republic of Georgia this morning, a ceasefire with Russia appears to be holding. Georgia confirms that Russian tanks have moved to the city of Gori, but Georgia says they're only there to help Russian troops move out. Georgia also says earlier reports of explosions around Gori were the result of Russian troops clearing unexploded ordnances. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is expected to arrive in Tbilisi later today to reinforce U.S. efforts to rally the world in defense of a free Georgia. She spoke yesterday in Washington, D.C.
This is not 1968 and the invasion of Czechoslovakia, where Russia can threaten its neighbors, occupy a capital, overthrow a government, and get away with it. Things have changed.
Russia has questioned whether or not Georgia has the right to claim South Ossetia and Abkhazia as part of the territory. Syria has agreed to a long-standing Lebanese demand for a demarcation of their common border. Leaders from both nations say they will form a committee to negotiate an agreement on the border. They've agreed to establish full diplomatic ties for the first time since both gained independence from France 60 years ago. The man who shot and killed Arkansas Democratic Party Chairman Bill Guatney had been fired from his job at Target just hours before he killed the chairman. Police say there was no indication that Timothy Johnson knew Guatney. Johnson fled the scene, and police shot and killed him after he led them on a 30-mile car chase.
A new report from the Labor Department this morning shows that the jobless claims dropped by 10,000 last week, but that's a smaller decline than economists expected, and it means unemployment is still at its highest level in 6 years. Inflation rose in July at its fastest rate in 17 years, with consumer prices up by 0.8%. That's twice the expected rate. The Labor Department blames surging energy and food costs. The next census, well, it's not coming until 2010, but today the Census Bureau reports that U.S. minorities will soon become majorities, much faster than they thought it. That's by 2042. Catherine?
Here are the numbers for today. Oil is near $117 a barrel. The Dow was down a little under 1% to close at 11,532. And the S&P was down just slightly. It opens at 1285. And, of course, we also want to know if you can answer our takeaway question about how you change your schools.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, Catherine Lanfer is sitting in for John Hockenberry.
Hey, Adora.
Hey there, Catherine. And we're going to begin in Pakistan, where President Pervez Musharraf, whose political opponents have been calling for him to face a vote of confidence vote, actually urged national unity and reconciliation today, as opposed to resigning, which were the reported rumors. Joining us now for the very latest is Mark Dummett, BBC correspondent coming to us from Islamabad. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Thank you. Yeah, the line's not great. I don't know, maybe something in the atmosphere here in Pakistan. There's a storm brewing, so forgive me if I don't understand or hear all of your questions.
Well, let's just start with there were rumors that Musharraf might step down today, which is Independence Day for Pakistan, but he didn't do that. Instead, what did he say to the public today? Oh, I think we might have lost Mark there.
We had a bit of a technical difficulty there,
and certainly we'll try to get back to Pakistan if we can. But, Catherine, I think you have another story for us.
We certainly do. We're going to go now to Cliff Levy, who is the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times, hoping to talk to him about what is going on. Diplomatic efforts, of course, just getting underway today to resolve the conflict between Georgia and Russia. But there are those critics who look at the situation and say that there really isn't much that American and European diplomats can do. To get more on that, we're going to go to Cliff, who joins us from Moscow. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. What options are there for American, as Condoleezza Rice, you know, makes her way over to Georgia today, and we know that in Moscow diplomatic talks are also starting, what options really do the Europeans and the Americans have?
Well, I mean, there are not a lot of easy options. There are sort of broad options in kind of the international arena. For example, military cooperation between the U.S. and Russia. The U.S. has already today canceled some naval maneuvers between the two countries. There are sort of these kind of symbolic gestures. Moving ahead, there is, for example, Russian membership in the World Trade Organization, which is pending at this point and which any single country can block. There's also more drastic measures like Russian membership in a group of eight countries. For example, Senator John McCain, the Republican presidential candidate, has called for Russia to be kicked out of the G8.
And Cliff, I'm going to stop you right now because I think, as my colleague Adore Udoji was saying earlier today before we went on air, it's pretty clear that Russia isn't going to make the WTO in the same way Georgia is probably not going to make NATO. But what sense do we have that Russia even cares at this point?
I'm sorry, you got cut off. Russia even cares about the WTO or NATO?
Yes. That these threats actually carry any weight to a country that looks from some observer's standpoint as if it's so intent on redrawing the map that this isn't really going to function as a serious threat to them.
Well, you know, from the viewpoint of Moscow and from there are a lot of contradictory feelings going on here. Russia, on the one hand, wants to assert its standing in the world. It wants to show that it once again is a player. On the other hand, it still seeks the approval of the West, and I think that cannot be underestimated. So to say that Russia doesn't really care at all about any of these activities or actions, I think would be a misunderstanding of the situation. The fact is that Russia is acutely sensitive to how it's perceived in the world and to how other countries treat it. So I think, you know, if they didn't care about any of this, they'd be marching into Tbilisi right now, and they're not. So, some of the very hawkish things that you perhaps hear in some Western capitals or in Washington now about how Russia is completely flouting the international order, I think that may not entirely capture the dynamic that's going on. There is a certain line that at least at this point they're not ready to cross. And I think they're not ready to cross it because they know that the backlash would be pretty severe.
Now, Cliff, given that we have somebody that just came over the wire saying that it looks as if Russian forces are determined to make sure that there is no Georgian army left to fight, that they are trying to dismantle whatever military infrastructure there is, what exactly is that line that Russia won't cross?
Well, I saw that bulletin that just came over the wire also. That has not been fully fleshed out. And, you know, given that this is a war and this is a conflict on the ground, there's been a lot of sort of information that's come out that has later proved to be not entirely true. So I would urge some caution until we have a chance to really assess what's going on the ground. I'm sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, certainly with the fact that we have all of these conflicting reports about what's going on, caution is certainly the word.
And we're going to bring in, I'm going to ask you to hold on, Cliff, because we're just going to bring into this conversation Jonathan Marcus, who is a diplomatic correspondent from the BBC, coming to us from London. And Jonathan, what's your take on the fact that now U.S. officials are saying Russia is apparently sabotaging airfields and other installations in Georgia, and this is coming on the heels of five explosions witnesses say they have heard near the city of Gori?
Well, look, clearly, as my colleague there said a moment ago, a lot of the reports coming out of Georgia have not been well sourced, and we don't have any independent confirmation of this. I mean, clearly, in that small part of Georgia that the Russian forces still occupy outside of the two separatist enclaves, it looks as though the Russians clearly are intent on doing as much damage as they can to Georgia's military infrastructure to make sure that Georgia is not in a position to launch any kind of military operation against the separatist areas in the near future. I mean, clearly, it will be no surprise if in due course the Americans and others choose to rebuild parts of Georgia's military forces, certainly mm-hmm. with defensive weapons. But the Russians are the masters on the ground at the moment in the areas that they are continuing to hold. The problem with this peace agreement is that it has no timelines to get the Russians to pull back. The Russians are using all sorts of excuses about their role as peacekeepers to maintain stability.
So the ceasefire essentially really has no teeth. Let's take a look at the diplomatic efforts that are being made, particularly today as Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in France for meetings with the President Sarkozy there. And then we'll be moving to Georgia. What kind of influence is this trip, do you think, going to carry at all for any of the parties?
Well, look, Condoleezza Rice and the Americans, I think, are eager to make sure that they and the Europeans are all reading as far as possible from the same song sheet. I think the peace agreement, the ceasefire accord anyway, that President Nicolas Sarkozy took to Moscow and to Tbilisi was very much an immediate off-the-cuff effort. It owed its origins more in Europe than it did necessarily in Washington. So I think the Americans are very eager to try and ensure that the French president, who is clearly the in pole position for the Europeans on this, and perhaps not quite as tough maybe as some in the Bush administration would like, they're eager to see the Americans and the Europeans as far as possible on the same page.
And Cliff, do you think there's been so much talk about how Russia's action has taken the world aback, and particularly the United States? Do you think that's a fair statement, and were the signs there, and are the signs there as to what Russia hopes to accomplish through this?
Well, let me just add something that my colleague just add to something that my colleague said. You know, it's been noticed here that Condoleezza Rice is only going to Tbilisi; she's not going to Moscow, and that's a pretty stark symbol because. Mm. The French President Sarkozy went to both Moscow and Tbilisi. Angela Merkel, the German leader, is coming to Moscow tomorrow. It's an interesting sign that Bush, the President Bush, did not send his Secretary of State to both capitals, only to one. I mean, you could argue either side on whether or not that's a mistake or not, whether you want to be more inclusive or more provocative.
But are they making a statement? Are the Russians taking that as some kind of statement that Rice is not coming to Moscow?
Oh, clearly. It's been very noted here that Rice is not coming to Moscow. I mean, Secretary Rice has been to Moscow many times. She's a Russia expert. She speaks decent Russian. The fact that she's only going to Tbilisi really is being taken as a statement here. In terms of, you know, what Russia is trying to demonstrate to the world, I think obviously they are trying to show that they have a sphere of influence on the rim of the old Soviet Empire, and that they feel that it's important to preserve that, rightly or wrongly.
Rightly or wrongly. I think that you're going to be saying that, rightly or wrongly, Cliff, I think a lot of people are going to be saying that over the next days and weeks as this situation continues and is looked back upon. Cliff Levy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cliff Levy, the Moscow Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and we also had on the line Jonathan Marcus. Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Jonathan Marcus is a diplomatic correspondent at the BBC.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And we're going to head back to Pakistan, where we have reestablished a line that we lost there. And we're talking about President Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan. There were reports yesterday suggesting that he would resign today on Pakistan's Independence Day. But instead, he did make a televised speech, but it wasn't about resigning. And for more, we're going to head back to Mark Dummett, who is a BBC correspondent in Islamabad. Hi there, Mark.
Hi there. Yeah, hopefully this line will
we'll hold.
Yeah.
So what did President Musharraf have to say today? He certainly didn't say he was stepping down.
Yeah, he avoided the issue basically that's dominating politics here in Pakistan, which is that his parties or parties which supported him lost elections in February. They've now formed the government and they want him out. There's an awful lot of speculation that he was going to resign, as you said, but he didn't. Instead, he made some pretty bland statements about unity and reconciliation. And he said that that's what the country needs to tackle the big problems they're facing, namely an economic meltdown and the rising threat of militants.
And not only that, he didn't even address any of the specific allegations that have been made by the coalition ruling party, which is trying to impeach him, that he was corrupt and had spent $700 billion of U.S. aid badly, that he had violated the Constitution by sacking all of those judges last year. Nothing, right?
No, I don't think he was ever going to. Certainly, the governing coalition would like him to answer those allegations. And if it gets its way, then an impeachment. The impeachment process will start in Parliament sometime next week, possibly next week, and then he will have a chance to defend himself. I mean, he's always denied and that he's guilty of such misconduct. The issue of where the U.S. money went, the $700 million a year that he supposedly siphoned off or misused, I mean, that's an incredibly sensitive issue here. He would deny that. I mean, and in fact, many people who would otherwise criticize him have come out in the papers and defended him on this and said, well, it's impossible for him to have misspent this money so badly because there are people sitting in the embassy here, the American embassy, counting the invoices, the receipts, and making sure that it isn't siphoned off.
And there certainly have been some reports that perhaps Pakistan's closest Western allies, the U.S. and the U.K., have been helping to mediate a deal which would allow Musharraf to step down gracefully. Have you heard any talk about that or any other reporting about that in Pakistan?
Well, I mean, they deny it. The embassies here, the British and the American embassies here deny it. But there's no doubt that it's, you know, what they want is a government here in Islamabad that they can deal with, and one that is dealing with the militants along the border. I mean, that's where the Taliban, who are going into Afghanistan, are based. It's where the Al-Qaeda leadership is believed to be. They want that dealt with, and they want the government here in Islamabad to deal with that. So that they, if this, if the future of Musharraf drags on, I mean, this impeachment process drags on for months, the worry is that the government won't, and the military here won't be dealing with the problem of the militants. So it is believed that they are pushing the different players here, are helping the different players come up with a solution whereby Musharraf leaves gracefully. He won't contest the impeachment. He'll go safely. He won't be charged with any criminal wrongdoing. He'll be allowed to leave the scene peacefully so that the government could then tackle the serious issues.
But is there a sense that Musharraf would agree to that?
Well, I mean, this is the big debate here in Islamabad. I mean, he is a former commando, special forces man. He, in the past, has always presented himself as a fighter, someone who never gives up, who stares challenges in the face and defeats them. So certainly it would go against the character, his character, to bow out quietly. I mean, he's also a proud Pakistani. He's a patriot who feels that he genuinely is the man who can save this country. So it would go against his character, but then maybe it's not up to him anymore. I mean, maybe he has lost so much support that he can't decide. That is the feeling, the growing feeling here in Islamabad, that he simply doesn't have many supporters left who will be prepared to help him.
Huh, certainly a turn of the tide for a man who was an absolute power there for 8 years.
Absolutely, but his power has just been draining away over the past year and a half, as has his popularity. He's still respected by many Pakistanis, if not most Pakistanis, for what he's done. He's seen as a pretty sort of straight-talking, straightforward man. As I say, a proud Pakistani who took some difficult decisions, particularly after 9/11, throwing his weight behind the US's war on the militants. But it's seen that he's made so many mistakes in the last year and a half. He sacked, if you remember, all the top judges who who he was worried were going to stand in his way for
so
re-election.
So perhaps too many mistakes. One too many mistakes, I guess that's one way of putting it. Mark Dummett, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mark Dummett is a BBC correspondent. He was coming to us from Islamabad, and certainly more to come on that story of Pervez Musharraf. But now we're getting some headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Thanks very much. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Have some grim economic numbers out this morning. Inflation in July spiked to its highest rate in 17 years. Consumer prices were up 0.8%. The Labour Department blames surging energy and food costs. And jobless claims dropped by 10,000 last week. That's a smaller decline than economists expected, and it means unemployment is still at its highest level in 6 years. The Associated Press is reporting that a US official is saying that Russia is sabotaging airfields and other military infrastructure in Georgia as its forces pull back. This official said the Russian strategy seems like a deliberate attempt to cripple the already battered Georgian military and prevent Georgia from fighting in the future. A ceasefire between Russia and the Republic of Georgia appears to be holding despite some reports of new violence in the flashpoint town of Gori. The US has threatened Russia with international isolation if it violates the latest ceasefire. Police are still searching for a motive after a gunman burst into the Arkansas Democratic Party headquarters and killed party chairman Bill Guatney. Police say that there is no indication that Timothy Johnson knew Guatney. Johnson has been fired from his job at Target and only hours before he went on the rampage, and the police eventually shot Johnson dead. And a firm handshake can be quite a good thing usually, but a John McCain supporter in West Bloomfield, Michigan, is very apologetic. He shook Cindy McCain's hand so hard she had to get treatment for a minor sprain. But Cindy McCain says she's doing fine right now.
Between that and the Hungarian weightlifting story you told us earlier, I'd like you to give up your obsession on broken bones.
Oh, Cindy's wrist isn't broken.
All right, you're right. They're both dislocated.
Yes.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Very much.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. After Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans has been revamping its school system, really in the midst of revamping it. And we'd like to hear from you about your school system. What would you change about it? What do you like about it? What are your thoughts on how to create a good school system? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. As Rick did, he tells us New Orleans education reform experience is still just that, an experiment, a large pilot. One can always create a great school by combining motivated parents, well-disciplined kids, and good teachers. Remove any one of those three legs and a school will likely fail. So, Rick, many thanks for that. 877-8-MY-TAKE for your thoughts. And I'm joined here today by Catherine Lanfer, who is in for John Hockenberry.
All right, Adora, if I was going to text you with the introduction to this next conversation, it would be OMG. If you register with the Barack Obama campaign, you can find out his vice presidential pick by text. The campaign will text you. Then again, how much information is the campaign going to get on you if you hand over that cell phone number? The merger of politics, marketing, and technology isn't new, but Mike Madden, a Salon.com columnist based in Washington, says that this campaign takes it further than we've ever seen before. Okay, Mike, what is so new here?
Well, what's new is the depth of what they're doing. Campaigns have always tried to find information on their supporters so that they could reach them. But the Obama campaign seems to be combining a bigger supporter database with a broader range of information on everyone in it to really put together something that hasn't been seen before, especially on the Democratic side.
I was just going to say, now, this really isn't a new thing for the Republican side. Bush-Cheney in 2004... impressed a lot of people with what they were doing.
Right, that's true. What the Obama people are doing is they're doing sort of more of it online, and they're doing more of it in ways that Democrats haven't done.
Give me an example.
Well, they're buying some consumer data so that they'll know, things like what magazines you subscribe to. They might know from your frequent buyer club at the grocery store what kind of foods you buy, and then they can combine that with what they already know about you from their own research, their own field work. So, they've got a 5 million person email list, and if you're on that, they know what time you open your email, so that they know when to send it to you, so that it doesn't get ignored.
Hmm. And how is this taking things further? You said that it was the depth of this.
Right. Well, in the past, a lot of Democratic candidates haven't combined all their databases into one pool, whereas the Obama campaign, everything they have, they put it into one database, and then their field people can access it, and their marketing people can access it, and their online marketing people can access it. And so every little piece of information that they have all gets put into the same box. For instance, I signed up at some point with my email address on their supporters' email list so I could see what they were sending their supporters. And then I separately signed up at some point with my phone number on a press credentialing list. And the week before the Washington, D.C. primary in February, I started getting calls on my cell phone, which I'd never given the campaign as a supporter, from people here asking if I was planning to vote and did I want to come volunteer. And it took me a while to realize that they'd sort of cross-referenced the email address which I'd given them both on the supporter list and on the press list with the phone number, which they only had on the press list, and handed one off to the other.
Now, let's say that you are a consumer and you've made sure that you're on no-call lists and you want to zealously protect your privacy, but hey, you wouldn't mind finding out who the vice presidential pick is. Have you just surrendered everything when you do that?
No, I don't think you've surrendered everything. You've surrendered your cell phone number, though, which means that you probably start hearing from the campaign.
What are the guarantees they're not going to give it back to those marketers they bought information from?
Well, I guess there aren't any, guarantees. They say they've got an opt-in policy, and their privacy guarantees are pretty good. But if you don't believe that they'll follow what they say, then you don't believe follow what they'll say.
Now, and how is the McCain campaign doing compared to the Obama campaign when it comes to this sort of merger of marketing, technology, and politics?
Well, they're using some of the techniques that Republicans had used for the past two cycles. The main difference is that they're not doing as much online, though that's in part because McCain's demographic isn't as wired, I guess, as Obama's is. But Republicans for the last couple cycles were already doing this sort of micro-targeting. You may recall that there was some focus in 2004 on how they knew, what kind of liquor their supporters drank and things like that. So McCain is doing that as well.
Given the research that you've done, then, can you draw a profile? I mean, what what everyday consumer purchases are going to tell you who the Obama supporter is, who the McCain supporter is?
You know, it's funny. The campaign people basically said there isn't really a magic bullet. It's more kind of a combination of things. So, you know, if you buy an iPod, that might not mean anything. But if you buy an iPod and also join the, you know, World Wildlife Federation and also live in an apartment building, then that might make you an Obama supporter.
That is Mike Madden, Washington columnist for Salon.com. Thanks for that, Mike. Now we're going to turn to Femi Oke and the latest headlines.
Thanks so much, Catherine. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the hour. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in France meeting with the French President Nicolas Sarkozy at his summer home for emergency talks on the situation in Georgia. She'll head to Paris later today to meet with the foreign French minister. Rice also heads to the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, tomorrow. A U.S. official says that Russian troops are sabotaging airfields and other military infrastructure in Georgia as the forces pull back. And there's no independent as yet of these accusations, no independent confirmation of these accusations yet. Libya and the United States have signed a deal settling all outstanding terror-related lawsuits between the two countries. The agreement clears the way for the restoration of full diplomatic relations. The deal also gives the Libyans immunity from any future terror lawsuits. The settlement means that there could be a U.S. embassy in Libya by the end of the year. The Labour Department is reporting that jobless claims dropped by 10,000 last week, but that's a smaller decline than economists expected. Unemployment is still at its highest level in 16 years, and last month inflation rose at its fastest rate in 17 years. Consumer prices rose by 0.8%, that's twice the expected rate. Now, every year in San Jose, they have a competition for very bad prose writing. It's in honour of the Victorian author who wrote the novel back in 1830 that started, "It was a dark and stormy night."
Love that beginning.
Garrison Spick has won the competition, but let me read you one of my favourites here. This is from Alex Hall. "Like a mechanic who forgets to wipe his hands on a shop rag and then goes home, hugs his wife and gets a grease stain on her favourite sweater. Love touches you and marks you forever." That's so bad. It's great.
You really have to concentrate to follow that one.
I love that one.
Think of how you can really play with it, though, and then you bleach it out. Thanks, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. We are exactly 5 years away from the day, Catherine, when 50 million people across America and eastern Canada were going about their day.
Yes.
When suddenly
the lights went out at 4:11 this afternoon. We saw flickering of the computers, light flickering, and moments later, the lights completely shut down. We are working on emergency backup power. We do have reporters.
That was Richard Hake on New York Public Radio's air, sounding an alarm for what would turn out to be to be North America's largest blackout in history. Though it did trigger immediate fears, anxiety, and panic coming just 2 years after 9/11, quickly it became apparent it wasn't terrorism at all. Rather, a sad byproduct of our nation's aging infrastructure. There was much relief and even some celebrating.
Happened. Okay, where were you?
I was walking down the street and ended up walking up 27 flights of stairs to get to my apartment.
Oh,
and it was hot that day. And I'm sure anyone who was here or in Canada remembers exactly how hot it was. And that would include Vincent Barbaccia. He was at his store, the Lemon Ice King of Corona in Queens, right, Vincent?
How you doing? Good morning.
Hey. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, yes, I was. And it was pretty frightening walking in and seeing that all my boxes were off and the freezer was off and everything that we, you know, produced that day might have been wasted, you know.
So were you worried about terrorism and looters? What immediately came to mind of what was going to happen next?
Yeah, at first, you know, of course, what we had just gone through, you know, in the last couple of years, it was, you know, that's the first thought. But eventually they assured us that it was a, you know, that it was a blackout and, you know, nothing to do with terrorism, just, you know, just Con Edison being Con Edison. So, because I have gone through this, you know, a couple of years back we went through this. Yeah, so we just, you know, waited and hope for the best.
What happened to your all that Italian ice, though?
Well, we have a big, obviously we have the big freezer which we store most of our product. And that will hold for about 24 hours before anything happens. So we make sure nobody goes into the freezer to pull any product out. But the boxes in the front that we actually serve out of, they would just eventually, obviously, they would just start melting as the day went along. So we sold whatever product we could. Then towards the end of the night, we just started giving out whatever was, you know, whatever was left, whatever we could salvage.
And how would you describe the people who were walking by and the people you handed out some Italian ice, some fine Italian ice to?
Oh, it was terrific to them. It was like a party because we stayed open till about 3 o'clock. Where we got rid of whatever product there was, you know, what we gave away, and then obviously we had the big cleanup after that, you know, with the product and ice is melting, and like I said, all through the night we had candles up.
So you ended up having a good time.
It was pretty good. It was a pretty good time. We took out whatever foods we had in the freeze in the regular refrigerators, and I had a couple of kids that stayed with me through the night. Basically, we stood open until about 3 o'clock. And like I said, we had people walking by with candles in groups. And like I said,
so for one day, New Yorkers all came together.
It was terrific.
Pretty much of a happy ending for a blackout that was the largest in history. Thank you, Vincent Barbaccia.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
He's the co-owner of the Lemon Ice King Corona.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. We are exactly 5 years away from the day, Catherine, when 50 million people across America and eastern Canada were going about their day.
Yes.
When suddenly
the lights went out at 4:11 this afternoon. We saw flickering of the computers, light flickering, and moments later, the lights completely shut down. We are working on emergency backup power. We do have reporters.
That was Richard Hake on New York Public Radio's air, sounding an alarm for what would turn out to be to be North America's largest blackout in history. Though it did trigger immediate fears, anxiety, and panic coming just 2 years after 9/11, quickly it became apparent it wasn't terrorism at all. Rather, a sad byproduct of our nation's aging infrastructure. There was much relief and even some celebrating.
Happened. Okay, where were you?
I was walking down the street and ended up walking up 27 flights of stairs to get to my apartment.
Oh,
and it was hot that day. I'm sure anyone who was here or in Canada remembers exactly how hot it was. And that would include Vincent Barbaccia. He was at his store, the Lemon Ice King of Corona in Queens, right, Vincent?
How you doing? Good morning.
Hey. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, yes, I was. And it was pretty frightening walking in and seeing that all my boxes were off and the freezer was off and everything that we, you know, produced that day might have been wasted, you know.
So were you worried about terrorism and looters? What immediately came to mind of what was going to happen next?
Yeah, at first, you know, of course, what we had just gone through, you know, in the last couple of years, it was, you know, that's the first thought. But eventually they assured us that it was a, you know, that it was a blackout and, you know, nothing to do with terrorism, just, you know, just Con Edison being Con Edison. Because I have gone through this, you know, a couple of years back we went through this. Yeah, so we just, you know, waited and hope for the best.
What happened to your all that Italian ice, though?
Well, we have a big, obviously we have the big freezer which we store most of our product, and that will hold for about 24 hours before anything happens. So we make sure nobody goes into the freezer to pull any product out. But the boxes in the front that we actually serve out of, they would just eventually, obviously, they would just start melting as the day went along. So we sold whatever product we could. Then towards the end of the night, we just started giving out whatever was, you know, whatever was left, whatever we could salvage.
And how would you describe the people who were walking by and the people you handed out some Italian ice, some fine Italian ice to?
Oh, it was terrific. To them, it was like a party, because we stayed open till about 3 o'clock, where we got rid of whatever product there was, you know, what we gave away, and then obviously we had the big cleanup after that, you know, with the product and ice is melting. And like I said, all through the night, we had candles up.
So you ended up having a good time.
It was pretty good. It was a pretty good time. We took out whatever foods we had in the freeze, in, you know, the regular refrigerators. And I had a couple of kids that stayed with me through the night. Basically, we stood open until about 3 o'clock. And like I said, we had people walking by with candles in groups. And like I said,
so for one day, New Yorkers all came together.
It was terrific.
Pretty much of a happy ending for a blackout that was the largest in history. Thank you, Vincent Barbaccia.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
He's the co-owner of the Lemon Ice King Corona.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. We're going to turn now to Femi Oke, who has the latest headlines for us. Hey, Femi.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the hour. It's been several hours of claim and counterclaim from the Republic of Georgia. Let's see, just get you caught up on the latest. Georgian officials indicate that the shaky truce with Russia is holding. The Georgian Interior Minister said that Russian troops hadn't renewed their assault on the city of Gori, but were in the process of pulling out. Now a U.S. official has told the Associated Press that Russian troops are sabotaging Georgian airfields and other military infrastructure as they pull their forces back. The Labor Department says that unemployment is still at its highest level in 6 years. That's despite today's report of a week of declines in claims. Police are trying to come up with answers as to why a man with no criminal record shot and killed the chairman of Arkansas Democratic Party yesterday afternoon. Timothy Johnson himself was shot and killed in the shootout with police after the attack. And finally, she was a famous cook, author, television personality, and spy.
How about a last-minute dinner party for 300 people today on The French Chef?
Well, that's the wonderful Julia Child. Her personal spy records can be looked up today. She was a spy during World War II, and there are many more spy revelations made public in the National Archives as they release more than 35,000 top-secret personal files. Also, down as a spy during World War II was the Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, Major League catcher Mo Berg, and the film actor Sterling Hayden.
Ah, those must have been very interesting times.
Catherine does a Julia Child, don't you?
Today on The Espionage Chef.
Very good.
Couldn't help it.
Very
tried
nice.
Not to do that.
All right, have a good morning, all.
Thanks, Femi.
Thanks, Femi. We're going to take a look at the power grid, some innovation and some new technology. And this question comes up because today, this afternoon, we will celebrate 5 years since a massive power outage literally stunned 50 million people in the Northeast, the Midwest, and parts of Canada. And as soon as terrorism was ruled out, the lights were barely back on before major questions were being asked about the antiquated power system. For some answers, at least, we're turning now to Bracken Hendricks, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thanks for being with us, Bracken. And what did we learn about what was broken, and how are we trying to fix it?
Well, you know, what we have today with our grid network is really, it's a 19th century technology. It hasn't changed very much since it was invented by Tesla, the scientist, in the late 1800s. And it's now powering a 21st century economy that's changed tremendously. So what we saw with the blackout in the Northeast was a very, very costly situation where we haven't been investing in modernizing and updating our infrastructure. It cost billions of dollars. We just heard that story about a small businessman and the kind of impact it has when you lose access to power. But there's been some research done by the solar energy industry that if there were just small amounts of solar energy at particular points around the grid, you could have prevented the kind of cascading power failure that happened with that blackout. So as we think about where the grid is going, we have the opportunity to bring together modern information technology, communications technology, and turn it together with our energy infrastructure.
Now, Bracken, this is Catherine Lanfer. Let's cut to the chase here. Who pays for this?
Well, actually, it needs to be paid for with some real public investment up front, but it's the type of spending that ultimately is a real investment. I think it's ultimately a public-private partnership.
Well, here's what I'm getting to, though. When you look at people who are early adopters, they've put up their own solar panels, and not all of us have the money to retrofit a house, as it were.
Well, and that's one of the barriers to the adoption of the smart grid is that making the kinds of investments that the public sector or the utilities or that and consumers ultimately need to make, it's probably not cost effective if you're just trying to modernize your electrical meter or just enable installation of solar power on your roof. But once you start putting together all of these technologies, the payback is enormous. It ultimately is going to create tremendous cost savings and tremendous new economic opportunity to have this intelligent grid. What a smart grid is going to do, it's going to enable the distribution system of electricity to share information back and forth from the homeowner back to the power plant so that you can do things like have real-time pricing where you actually pay the cost of the energy when it's produced. So if you are using peak load during the height of the day, it might be more expensive, but it also creates the opportunity to do your laundry in the evening and realize a cost savings.
Is any of this actually happening today?
There's a very advanced smart grid in Italy that has, I think, 200,000 homes on it. In Austin, Texas, they've been moving for the last several years to get smart metering, these digital meters that allow more flexible pricing and really encourage energy conservation and allow homeowners to realize cost savings, as well as the opportunity to connect energy, renewable energy appliances like solar panels to the grid and sell energy back. There's also the city of Boulder, Colorado, has just announced a very forward-looking utility out there, Xcel Energy, and they're going to make the whole city of Boulder, Colorado, a smart grid pilot. So this is on the cusp of happening. And one of the really exciting things...
But Bracken, let me just stop you there, though, because I'm curious about... Was there any sense of urgency following, it was an enormous collapse in 2005 when half of the northeastern seaboard was in a blackout. It spread all the way to the Midwest, and then it headed up to Canada. I'm surprised that there haven't been more of these innovative programs implemented.
What we're looking at is a very fundamental change in how we view the electrical grid. And I'm actually not surprised that it's taking a little while to catch on, but I think that what we're seeing now, a few years out from the blackout, is that there is real momentum and the technology is really there. Things like smart meters, things like integration of renewable energy to maintain stable load, and also some of the economics of just rising prices of natural gas and coal and the energy that we produce. Suddenly there is a very, very powerful motivation to get the kinds of radical improvements in energy efficiency that are possible. There's a really exciting feature of the smart grid, which is when you really get this whole distributed network, it's really like shifting from a mainframe computer to a network of connected desktops. We're going to have multiple pathways for energy to flow, and the utility will be able to reach out and access energy efficiency as a new source of generation. So when they need that extra unit of peak power in the hottest day of August when everyone's running their air conditioners, they'll have the tools to bring down demand and with consumers, you know, shutting off water heaters if people have given their permission to reduce their load, those sorts of things, or accessing stored energy that may be stored in batteries from solar panels, or ultimately...
So essentially what you're saying is the new technology would just radically increase efficiency.
Absolutely. Efficiency and the integration of renewables, it'll allow people to do things like there's a new generation of cars called plug-in electric hybrid cars, which are being discussed. They're really exciting technology. GM has something called the Volt that they're going to be introducing in a couple years. Basically, they can run for 40 miles and use no gasoline. They cut carbon emissions by 30%.
40 miles and no gasoline?
No gasoline because they're using electricity. So they get equivalent of 100 miles for every gallon of gasoline they use. That's really exciting, but it means that those cars are going to be drawing energy from the grid. So what that's going to require is that we have controls in the charging system for the cars, so that the cars only charge at night when there's excess capacity and not during the peak of the day.
Right.
But the cool thing here is in the full smart grid, those cars, once you take them to work and plug them in, if the building needs extra capacity, suddenly the garage is going to become a generator. It's going to become a major power source.
Bracken, we've got to go, Bracken, but you're almost describing something from the Jetson.
It sounds futuristic, but it's coming down the pike in the next couple of years.
Okay, Bracken Hendricks, thank you. Thank you, sir. Bracken is the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He works on issues of climate change and energy independence.
And he is one enthusiastic advocate.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
We're always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, Friend Feed, Twitter. And want to remind you, of course, that we are continuing our coverage on the conflict of Russia and Georgia, and also about texting and presidential campaigns, power, electrical power.
And as always, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your take. And here's today's takeaway.
If the building needs extra capacity, suddenly the garage is going to become a generator.
A generator. That was Bracken Hendricks from the Center for American Progress, and he was just explaining how electric cars will be used in the future. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm Catherine Lanford.
And this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.